From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, what it means to be hurt. From the streets of Spanish Harlem in the aftermath of an explosion.
Anyone affected by this tragedy will be helped. Anyone, regardless of immigration status.
To Laredo, Texas, where we rediscover our love for that special burn.
I work at the U.S. consulate. Girls can take it woo, to a whole other level.
Jalapeños, $2 dances, and a conversation with Jose Antonio Vargas, undocumented immigrant and journalist. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. We begin by talking with a man whose life embodies the experience of a generation of American youth who are undocumented. Jose Antonio Vargas came to the United States from the Philippines when he was only 12 years old. As a California teenager, he went to the DMV to get his driver's license, but that's when he found out he didn't have permission to be in the country. That didn't stop him from graduating from San Francisco State University and growing into an amazing career in journalism. He was a star political reporter at the Washington Post and won a Pulitzer Prize in 2008. In 2011, he came out as undocumented. His new documentary, Documented, tells his story. Jose Antonio, I know you're jetting from one place to the next. In fact, we're speaking to you from inside of a car. So thanks for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you so much for having me.
You and I were actually doing a panel after having watched your documentary, which is a very political film, but it's also a very personal film about your personal hurt in relationship to your mom and your family. But at that time, I talked about you and me and others as being American journalists, because we are. And you looked at me almost with tears in your eyes, and you said, no one has ever called me an American journalist.
Wow. You were the first person to do that, and I will never forget it. Interestingly enough, I was actually just at San Jose State University, which is not too far from where I grew up, and it was the first journalism department to deliberately invite me. And not only that, to honor me with the William Hearst Award or something, which was nice. But, you know, like, it's kind of weird being in this position where, like, people are giving me awards where really what I need is a green card. But when I was there, I was talking about how hurt I was by the traditional journalism community, who in some ways I feel has kind of excommunicated me. Because, you know, I happen to be gay and I happen to be undocumented. And so, therefore, I have a quote-unquote agenda. Right, that I'm no longer, quote unquote, a journalist because I have taken a stance. I really want to have kind of a broader conversation about what it means for the journalism industry, in which people like David Brooks and Ezra Klein, you know, can write about politics and policy and can be considered, you know, journalists, you know, who are writing analyses, while people like us have agendas. Like, what is that about? Right?
What do you think it's about?
Journalism in this country is still largely, you know, dictated and structured by heterosexual white men. Jill Abramson becomes the first woman editor of the New York Times, and you feel as if the skies had parted. Like, what are they going to do when they get a Puerto Rican one? I mean, look at, for example, how we're covering Ukraine versus how we're covering Venezuela. I mean, that right there tells you the bias, right? Of course I'm interested in what happened in the Ukraine and what's happening with Putin and Russia. But think about the coverage in South America or Africa or Asia. You know, for the most part, it's, you know, it's not that existent because most journalists, most white journalists, still mostly care about Europe.
So what has been the response as you've traveled around and you talk about, you know, being not only out of the closet as a gay man, but talking about this, you know, redefining America, who's telling the story, who gets to decide. What's the response that you're getting from the places that you travel to?
That there is an oceanic gap between what people perceive the issue is and what the reality is, as it, you know, according to people like us, to actually undocumented people, right?
And so part of what happens in your film, and I actually want to bring in a clip here, is a moment when you are in a restaurant in the South.
Yes, in Birmingham.
What is it? In Alabama?
Yeah, in Birmingham.
In Birmingham, Alabama. And you engage somebody in a conversation who has a very different opinion about the issue than you do.
What was that?
You got your papers?
What if I told you I didn't?
Well, then you need to get your ass on then. That's what I say.
I've been paying my taxes since I was 18.
Well, good, good.
That's good, man.
That's great.
Thank you.
Good
thing
for security.
You came over and you became a productive member of society, yeah. Right? That's what you did, right?
So do you think that man was basically, as you say, a victim of the mainstream media, that he's carrying all of these prejudgments about this issue because of what he's basically been hearing on the main or seeing or reading on the mainstream media? Or do you think that there's something else that's going on?
To me, that man exemplifies a lot of people that I actually have interviewed in the South who just have no conception, right? I mean, the moment I tell him I pay taxes, things shifted, right? And then he started
talking. In other words,
they
basically say, wait a second, you're quote-unquote illegal, but you're paying taxes?
Yes. So it's as simple a fact as that, which, by the way, I remember after we did that scene, which was like in fall 2012, and I just was starting to research how many times has the New York Times or the Washington Post and mainstream news organizations actually reported the fact that undocumented workers pay billions taxes in taxes and Social Security. And I think I found maybe three mentions. Right? Now, in contrast, how many times do groups like the Center for Immigration Studies, Numbers USA, like the Trifecta that for a decade has dominated how undocumented people are thought of in this country? How many times were they mentioned? A lot. Right.
So one of the things that you did with your documentary, you could have gone in a very kind of straight documentary form, talking about legal issues around immigration policy, the failure of, you know, Congress and the president to deliver. And you do talk about that. But very quickly in your documentary, one realizes that this is really it's a family story. It's a story of hurt, of separation from your mom. And really, it's the love story or the lack of love story between you and your mom, who you haven't seen now for decades.
And I love, by the way, Maria, that you described it as a love story, because for me, that's what the film is, right? I mean, for me, it's the kind of sacrifice and the kind of love that every parent, that every mother, you know, in this country, from the Italians to the Irish to the Jews, you know, to the Mexicans and the Chinese, this is what makes this country what this is about. And I think we need to show people what this broken system does to people, right?
So the truth is that you do not qualify for deferred action for childhood arrivals, yet you still call yourself the most privileged undocumented immigrant in the United States. What do you mean?
Because I feel like, you know, every day, at least 1,100 people get deported by this administration, every day. And what am I doing? I'm traveling across country, being interviewed by you, and I did a film. I have a responsibility to the people that, you know, aren't as privileged as I am from a class perspective, or because I look the way that I do, or because I speak the way that I do.
So, Jose Antonio, let me ask you this. I am sure that President Barack Obama feels very hurt, deeply hurt, when he starts seeing the hashtag deporter in chief. What do you say to the president who many would say, yeah, he's feeling hurt about this?
I think the fact of the matter is this is a president for which immigration is not a personal issue. You know, so if I were to, you know, if I were a journalist actually in front of him questioning him, I would ask him, you know, sir, is this personal to you?
And he might say, you know what, Jose Antonio, that's where you falter. You're going into the personal, and this is about politics, and you are, you're getting too emotional, and you would say what to him?
No, sir. I was one of the journalists that interviewed African-Americans who were personal, who felt personal about electing you as president. Look, I think the president is trying to do the best that he can. I think, of course, the president must be hurt that, you know, the first minority president who was elected not once but twice because of the Latino vote and the Asian vote is now being called prominently as a deporter in chief. You know, but sir, we need some leadership here.
And so to flip that then now back to democracy on a grassroots level, is that where you see that democracy is actually percolating, is in the what some people call the new civil rights movement, the dreamers who are protesting, taking to the streets, boycotting, taking over offices? Is that the response? Is that the proper response to what you're saying is a president who is not personally nor politically apparently prepared to act?
I don't think we're really fully embracing and studying yet what this dreamer movement means to America, right? The fact that it intersects so many issues about race, about class, about sexual orientation. As you well know, you know, the dreamer movement is led by a lot of undocumented LGBT people. I think, you know, somewhere James Baldwin and, like, you know, Harvey Milk must be smiling. The grassroots are really, as always been in the history of this country, kind of becoming the conscience and the soul, right? On the question of legalization versus citizenship, on the question of how hard must you push this president?
The president has said that he is, in fact, looking at this deeply, personally, considering his options as to make an executive order. Do you see this as actually moving someplace, or do you see this as, you know, political moves within the White House?
Well, I must quote one of the president's favorite writers, James Baldwin, who said that I must be an optimist because I am alive. But I do think that, and I do know, and I do think that the president understands that history is on the line. His legacy is on the line.
Finally, Jose Antonio Vargas, define American for us.
I define American as somebody who calls America his or her home. I define American as someone who wants to contribute to this country. And I define American as a fight. You know, I'm not privileged enough to be born in this country or to be a citizen of this country. America to me is something you earn and something you struggle for. It's not something that's just given to you.
Jose Antonio Vargas, it's wonderful to speak to you. Thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA and for telling us your story.
Thank you always for having me, Maria. I really appreciate it.
Jose Antonio Vargas is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. His new documentary, Documented, will air later this year on CNN. Jose Antonio is undocumented, Filipino, and American. We asked Jose Antonio Vargas, but now it's your turn to weigh in. What's your take on President Obama's so-called reevaluation of his deportation policies? Is it a fig leaf or a sign that real change is in the air when it comes to Latino and immigrant power? Tell us what you think. We're at LatinoUSA on Twitter. And coming up on LatinoUSA...
Mi abogada dice que yo no tengo por qué irme de aquí. Aquí hay justicia.
My lawyer says I don't need to leave here. Here, there is justice.
How something called a U visa can help victims of domestic violence who are immigrants. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Este dolor es tan grande que me cuesta respirar. Estoy mirando sin mirar. Mi cuerpo se adormece, mis dudas florecen más. Nada puedo ya mirar. Voy a caminar.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Undocumented immigrants who are victims of domestic violence face a double-edged sword. On the one hand, they can't turn to the police for fear of being deported. On the other, the abuse will continue as long as they don't reach out. But if they do call the police to report intimate partner violence, they could be eligible for a little-known program called the U Visa. From WGCU in Fort Myers, Florida, Ashley Lopez has our story.
Bueno, cuando yo conocí a mi pareja hace como 11 años, creí que todo iba a funcionar bien. Él era muy amable, muy bueno.
Angelica says at first his behavior wasn't that bad. She says she justified a lot of it because she loved him. She's talking about the first time she met her partner. We've changed her name for her safety. It's a familiar story. Angelica says the relationship was great at first. They were happy and had a child together. But after a while, Angelica's partner became abusive.
Al principio eran golpes pequeños, insultos, pero yo se lo justificaba porque lo quería.
Over time, the beatings and insults got worse, and she never told anyone about them. That's because Angelica is an undocumented immigrant from Mexico. She says she didn't want to call the police because she was afraid of getting deported.
Aguanté el maltrato porque yo no sabía que había tanta ayuda.
Women like Angelica think they are all alone in this situation.
Because they won't talk, they won't defend themselves. They're afraid to call the police. They're afraid to get any help from anywhere.
That's Maria Herrera. She's an immigration specialist. She works at the Amigo Center, which gives free legal help to undocumented people in the Fort Myers area.
And because they keep quiet, some of the U.S. citizens or residents or even other immigrants take advantage of that. And so, you know, they become victims.
After years of abuse, Angelica's partner eventually left her, taking her car with him. One day, she had enough and demanded he pay her back. But instead of handing over the money, Angelica says her boyfriend beat her worse than ever.
Ese día que él me golpeó, yo ni siquiera llamé a la policía. Él fue el que llamó a la policía.
Angelica says he was the one who called the police. He told the cops that she had threatened to kill him. The cops weren't fooled, though. Angelica was bleeding and badly hurt, while her partner was unscathed. So finally, he was thrown in jail.
Él no pudo mostrar nada. La que estaba golpeada y sangrando era yo.
Most importantly, Angelica now has something that could change her life, a police report that documents the abuse. This means she qualifies for a special visa called a U visa or a victim visa. U visas are a way for victims of certain crimes, including domestic abuse, trafficking, and torture, to get temporary legal status. They can apply for a green card after 3 years.
Hundreds and hundreds of cases come through our doors.
Yaroslava Garcia is a counselor at Abuse Counseling and Treatment in Fort Myers.
We see these cases every single day here at ACT. Every single day.
Besides their legal status, some immigrant women can face challenges because of the culture they were raised in. Garcia says domestic abuse is sometimes less stigmatized in their home countries, and fleeing the relationship can be out of the question.
Depending on the cultural background of the victim that we're talking about, they may not believe in divorce, or they may not understand the process of a divorce.
Garcia says most of the time, these victims don't know they have any rights. And if they leave their abusers and go to a shelter without ever calling the cops, they have no hope of getting a U visa in the future. For those who do qualify, it's a long road. Back at the Amigo Center, Maria Herrera says she has an immense caseload for U visas. She says each application is complicated and long and has high stakes.
If they get denied the U visa, then they are given a notice to appear in court and they could be deported.
If that happens, she can't help them. Herrera says luckily, in the years she's been applying for U visas, she's never been denied. If those victims do get a visa and they're separated from their abusers, they get a whole new life.
Yo ahora tengo ganas de seguir adelante, aprender un nuevo idioma, aprender una profesión.
Angelica says she wants to go to school and start a new career once she gets her U visa. The years of abuse took an emotional toll, especially on her young daughter. But she knows she's lucky to be getting help.
Mi abogada dice que
que yo no tengo por qué irme de aquí. Aquí hay justicia.
And Helica says sometimes there's justice for people who need it. For Latino USA, I'm Ashley Lopez in Fort Myers, Florida.
Pretty much everything is for sale along Roosevelt Avenue, which is a bustling commercial strip in Queens, New York City. For the right price, you can get Colombian pastries, cheap electronics, forged working papers, and even a dance. $2 is what it costs to dance a salsa or a bachata with a woman at one of the many bailarina bars along the avenue. They've been popping up to meet a particular demand in immigrant neighborhoods. We sent our producer, Marlon Bishop, on a little field trip to find out a little bit more about these $2 dance places. Hey, Marlon.
Hi, Maria.
All right, so Marlon, please explain, what exactly are these bailarina bars?
So bailarina bars are basically these bars where you can go, and there's women who work there, and you could pay them to dance with you at the rate of $2 a song. This concept has actually been around for a while. In the 1930s, there were these taxi dance halls all around the U.S. where women would charge by the minute to dance, like a taxi meter. But these new bailarina bars are really booming right now. There are about 50 of them on Roosevelt Avenue alone.
Wow. So tell me in particular, where did you go and what was it like?
I went to a place called El Gato Verde, the Green Cat. Inside, it's like any other bar. There's lots of colored lights, smoke machines, buckets of beer. They play all kinds of Latin music. Everything pretty ordinary, except it was completely packed with women, around 40 of them, just standing around, waiting for someone to ask them to dance. Other than dancing, you can also pay to have one of the women share a drink with you for 15 minutes, or rent their time at $40 an hour to sit and hang out with you at your table.
So, is it just dancing?
They're just dancing. There are some women who will take it further outside the club, but that's the exception, not the rule. For the most part, people go there to dance.
So, I don't get it, because why would you go to a bar and pay someone to dance with you? When this is New York City, there are salsa bars everywhere. You could just go and ask a woman to dance.
Well, that's what I wondered at first.
Me distraigo un rato bailando.
This is Juan Hernandez. He's a patron I met outside the club. He's 23, from Mexico. He immigrated a year ago. Hernandez works 10 to 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, at a Japanese restaurant. He showed me burn scars on his arms from kitchen accidents. He says he goes to the bars because it makes him forget about work for a few hours and helps him get rid of his stress. He says it goes about twice a month after he sends money home to Mexico.
Pienso que fue un negocio que se creó debido a la inmigración.
Okay, so who's this?
This is Diana Trejos. She's been dancing at different clubs on Roosevelt for 13 years. She says that the whole $2 dance industry exists because of immigration.
Son personas que viven con muchos problemas. Muchos vienen del campo.
She says her clients are really lonely. They have a lot of problems. Many come from poor rural areas and leave families in their home country.
Y solamente su único objetivo es trabajar.
Their whole life is about working to help out the people they've left behind. Sometimes they just need a little companionship. Someone to hear them out at the end of the day.
Hace 14 años vine de Colombia.
Diana was a single mother living in Colombia, and she came to the U.S. to help support her young children. She waitressed at first, but had trouble making ends meet.
Me dijo que había llegado a trabajar en un lugar de mesera, pero que ahí también
then,
bailaba.
Then a friend told her about these bars, where all you have to do is dance a little bit.
Cobraban por bailar, cosa que para mí era totalmente.
Diana thought it sounded weird, but she always loved dancing. She's from Cali, after all, the world's salsa capital. So she said, why not? And besides, the money was really good.
How much money does she make?
She told me the industry has gotten worse recently, but she used to be able to make between $100 and $300 a night. The main downside is that the clients are always falling in love with her. She needs to find ways to let them down gently.
It all sounds kind of okay, but what's the real story? I mean, what are the conditions for the women who work in these places? Are they trafficked? Are they abused?
Diana was actually one of a group of dancers who won a settlement with the Flamingo Club, also in Queens, over abusive practices. They included things like having to pay the club to work there, being fined for lateness, being verbally abused by the owner. Apparently, the Flamingo Club was by far the worst place to work, but I wouldn't be surprised if similar things were happening at other clubs.
All right, Marlon, so you know I love to dance. Now the question is, Did you dance?
Well, of course I danced.
And so what happened?
So I asked a nice woman named Monica to dance, and we danced a few bachatas. And after a few songs, she asked me if I'd buy her a drink. And we went over to the bar. The drinks you buy for the girls are 3 times as expensive as normal drinks. I paid $15 for a Corona, and they kicked back half to her. She starts telling me how handsome I am, and I say, thank you, that's very nice, but I'm actually a journalist, and I'd just like you to tell me your story. And this was pretty great. Right away, she tells me, okay, don't tell anyone here, but I actually don't even like men. She took out her cell phone and started showing me pictures of her girlfriend who lives in Medellin. It was actually kind of a really nice moment.
So after going through all of this, Marlon, did you get a chance to understand what the appeal is behind these bailarina bars?
You know, I did. I'm in a very different position than many of the day laborers who frequent these places, but I still kind of got it. When I was dancing with Monica, we were dancing open embrace, the way you would with someone you just met, and right away she takes my hand and puts it on her hip. And it's exciting. If it happened in real life, you'd think, wow, she likes me. There's some chemistry here. Sean Leonardo puts it this way.
Because, you know, that $2 exchange is a social contract.
So who's Sean Leonardo?
Sean Leonardo is an artist from Queens.
I created a performance party, a scenario where those roles would be reversed.
Wait a second. So it's a performance art project where the women pay the men to dance?
Exactly. So as a $2 dancer, Sean had some realizations about the nature of the exchange.
Our role wasn't to be ourselves, per se. Our role was to fulfill whatever they wanted for those $2 for that one song. The situation allows for someone to believe for a few minutes in whatever kind of relationship they want.
And so this is something I feel like I understood when I went to the club, which is, in a way, you're paying for the fantasy of it, the fantasy of this moment of romance, this little tiny moment between you and a stranger. And, you know, for a lot of immigrants who carry this tremendous loneliness and pain, it's the fantasy that that pain can just wash away. It just happens to be an illusion.
But don't we all kind of have our own illusions about our own success or about family or love? I mean, we all need certain illusions to get by, right?
Absolutely. I think that's true.
Damas y Caballeros, our producer, Marlon Bishop.
Thank you, Maria. Anytime.
And now, the hurt that comes from struggling with our bodies. About 10% of Americans struggle with eating disorders, which is true across every ethnicity. But in the Latino community, eating disorders often go underreported and undiagnosed. And there's some evidence that suggests that being multicultural makes Latinos especially susceptible.
I'm Ana E. Ortega, and I am recovering from an eating disorder.
My name is Corazon Tierra. I recovered from eating disorders 20 years ago.
I was 12 when the symptoms first started, and by 13, I had a full-blown eating disorder, and my parents did not know this was happening.
My mother was all the way on a diet to lose weight. So at early age, I became very concerned about my weight, and even though I was very skinny, I was completely afraid of becoming overweight. By the time I was a teenager, my eating disorder was already in full force.
It can be hard for any parent to recognize the signs of an eating disorder, but among people of color and immigrants, awareness tends to be especially low.
I think it took about a year and a half before they started realizing something was wrong.
She would try to feed me like home remedies to open my appetite, but I refused to do that.
Sometimes it's easier for Latino families to acknowledge the issue as a physical problem rather than a mental one. But going to the doctor comes with its own challenges. Anahi Ortega.
They concluded that I had an eating disorder and brought in my parents to talk with them. But it was a little hard because they do not speak English. And I was the translator. And so I was able to share what I wanted.
There are also cultural barriers to seeking help, like the high cost of getting treatment. Add to that the pressure of constantly straddling two cultures. Corazón Tierra.
We're supposed to look very skinny and very beautiful and in shape, but we're also supposed to be eating and enjoying food with our loved ones.
Dr. Yona Boya is a professor of counseling at Marymount University.
Somebody who grew up in Latino community where the standards of appearance are related to having a curvier body type and then goes to school into a primarily Caucasian institution and standards of appearance and eating habits and eating norms are all different. So these are all pressures that will put somebody at an increased risk.
When food is so closely tied to family life, it can take on a whole other meaning. Dr. Yona Boya again.
You receive two types of messages. You receive messages like that food is fun and it's celebration and eat, 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 and food is affection and participating in family meals is something that is highly regarded. And then when you step out of that culture, you're supposed to be thin now and you're supposed to have a certain body type and you're supposed to be eating healthy.
To get better, Latinos first have to overcome the stigma of looking for help.
I think that admitting it within our family will have to force other family members to acknowledge that issue as well, that I had an eating disorder, that it was a problem and that I was seeking help. But I couldn't do that. We couldn't do that because we wanted to keep our family in the perfect appearance.
Because eating disorders aren't talked about, many Latinos think they're rare, when really almost half of all Americans personally know someone with an eating disorder. Dr. Yona Boya again.
An eating disorder is believed to be a white middle class or upper class woman's issues. That puts Latinas and Latinos really at risk for just minimizing the fact that they have an eating disorder.
Men make up over 10% of people with the disorder. Corazón Tierra.
First, there is the layer of denial. Well, we don't have that problem in our community. It's only a white girl's problem. Or then there is the belief that this is not a serious problem, that it's something that it will pass.
But eating disorders never just go away. In fact, they have the highest mortality rate of any mental illness. And unlike a purely physical illness, patients can't recover unless they choose to let go of their old habits. They need to rely on the people around them for support, even when those people don't really understand what they're going through.
It's not okay when you say que estoy gorda or make what you think is funny comments.
It was a messy process, really. It wasn't so harmoniously done, but it was done. Now is, you know, they know what to say or not to say and how to support me.
Even the word for eating disorders in Spanish, trastorno alimentario, is scary. It means something like a mental hurricane. Estás trastornada. Recovery can be a hard road, but with hard work comes hope.
I had the genes and I had the environment that just triggered the eating disorder at a young age. And after 10 years, I finally was able to find recovery.
I have been free of eating disorders for almost 20 years now. And I always said that I'm not only recovered, but healed, because I never went back to that behavior.
Not just recovery, but healing. If you or somebody that you know is struggling with an eating disorder, contact the National Eating Disorders Association. All of their information is on our website at latinousa.org. Coming up on Latino USA, an explosion just blocks away from our studios in Harlem displaces dozens, and the community begins to heal.
Anyone affected by this tragedy will be helped. Anyone, regardless of immigration status.
Stay with us. No se vayan.
Ya no soy lo que antes era, ni lo que solía ser, ni lo que solía ser. Ya no soy lo que antes era, soy un cuadro de tristeza, arrimado en la pared. Ya no soy lo que antes era, ni lo que solía ser. Estoy triste, ignoro la causa de mi tristeza, la causa de
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today we're talking about what it means to be hurt. And I'm recording this, actually, just down the street from a community that is starting to heal. It's a chilly afternoon at the Salvation Army Center in Spanish Harlem. Here, the Red Cross has set up a shelter for East Harlem residents who were displaced by a gas explosion that took down two apartment buildings. At least 8 people were killed and dozens more were displaced. A majority of those sheltered at the Red Cross are Latinos. Many speak only Spanish. Many are undocumented, like longtime East Harlem resident Benjamin Mendoza.
Ya, pero cuando pasamos esa cosa, yo lo que me preocupaba uno por mi niño.
Benjamin spent an hour looking for his son after the gas pipe explosion that broke all the windows in his apartment, and they finally found him. Inside the shelter now, he waits with neighbors and family members for services from city agencies like the Housing Preservation Department and the Homeless Services Agencies. He doesn't speak English, so Benjamin relies on translators and bilingual officials who are on site.
Anyone affected by this tragedy will be helped, anyone, regardless of immigration status.
That's New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio at a church service in Spanish Harlem.
And it's very important to get that message out. I ask all of you to help spread that word clearly to people.
City officials and immigration activists want people to know they won't be turned over to immigration authorities if they seek help. Outside the shelter, Red Cross spokesperson Michael de Vulpierre clarifies.
We don't share information about people's immigration status with authorities. We respect the client's confidentiality.
The Mendoza family knows this very well. Mendoza went to his daughter's school, where they guided the family to the Red Cross shelter. Immigration activist Melissa McCrum, who works with the grassroots organization Make the Road, says New York City is a national example in disaster relief for immigrants.
New York City is way ahead of the rest of the country in making sure that they include undocumented immigrants in recovery assistance.
Having a U.S. citizen who's part of the family makes them eligible for more disaster relief programs. McCrum says in general, undocumented immigrants aren't eligible for longer-term federal programs. Local programs might be friendlier to them, but getting information to the undocumented can be difficult, especially, she says, for those most at risk.
Yeah, I think the folks that are especially at risk are single people or couples that don't have any children, single people or couples that have children that were not born in the United States. Also having children that are in the school system that create this connection between the family and the institutions that exist within the city lowers people's vulnerability.
Benjamin Mendoza and his family are now in a temporary apartment in East Harlem. And community activist McCrum says she's hopeful that new initiatives like a city ID card for all New York City residents, regardless of their status, will help.
I think that'd be a really huge step forward in creating this environment of trust. It's one thing to say, hey, you're eligible for this. It's another thing to say, look, we've recognized you guys. You have all the credentials you need to access these resources. I do think that's an important step forward in building the trust between the city and the undocumented community.
For now, our thoughts go out to our neighbors in Spanish Harlem who lost family and friends in the explosions. Latinas lead the pack when it comes to breastfeeding their babies at birth. In fact, over 80% of Latina moms do. That's according to a report by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And more Latinas nurse their children up to 12 months than any other ethnic group in the country. But there's still a lot of misconceptions about breastfeeding and a lot of pressure to get it right, whatever that means. Latino USA producer Brenda Salinas talked to some moms about breastfeeding while Latina.
I really thought it was going to be easy.
Yulia Delgado had read all of the parenting books, but one thing wasn't going according to plan.
I was pumping every 2 to 3 hours. I would get up through the night and pump. I would drink maltas like you will not believe to try to increase the production, and nothing was working.
After struggling for 2 months, she made a decision.
I had to start supplementing because not only for my baby's sake, but I was a wreck.
Luisa Colon was dealing with a completely different breastfeeding problem.
I was struggling to get into my apartment, and my son was a baby. He was in the carrier. He was crying. I had groceries, and one of my neighbors came out to help. She said, "Here, give him to me. I'll hold him while you take your jacket off." I did that, and she said, "Come on, get a bottle. He's obviously hungry." And I said, "He's hungry, but I'm going to sit down and breastfeed him." And it was this moment of, you're still breastfeeding? The expectation was that that's something you do early on. You supplement with formula, you move on to formula. The breastfeeding gets left behind.
She lived in a large Puerto Rican community in Brooklyn. The Latinas around her were shocked that she was still nursing her 20-month-old son.
I was used to being a Latina who got a lot of support from fellow Latinas, just being out in public. And suddenly it wasn't there.
Colon felt like she had to defend her personal choice to strangers.
I constantly heard that my baby wasn't chubby enough. He's so small. How old did you say he was again? And how much does he weigh? I mean, I must have had to answer that like a dozen times.
Sharon Medrano is a lactation consultant. She says she hears this a lot.
Some of it stems from the misconception. Some of it stems from some in the Latino community thinking that babies have to be chubby and chunky to be healthy, when in fact most breastfed babies tend to be on the leaner end.
The argument about how much to breastfeed really takes off online.
There's so much judgment, I feel like, out there. There was a mom breastfeeding her baby as like a protest in front of a formula information booth. That picture irked me so much because I felt like, that's great that moms are able to breastfeed and you know that their support is out there. But like once I decided to do formula, I felt like there wasn't that much support out there.
And on the other end of the breastfeeding spectrum,
they seem taken aback by the fact that I chose to do that, that I didn't do formula, that I continued to do it, that I would do it in public. And they weren't trying to be negative, but I could tell the same feelings of support weren't there.
As a lactation consultant, Medrano encourages women to be at peace with their choice.
When you're breastfeeding around Latinas, it's sometimes tough and you have to have like a little bit of a thick skin.
A strong support network at home is crucial.
I was really fortunate that we went home to a supportive environment, you know, my partner, my family.
Yulia Delgado eventually found a way to accept her choice.
My mom was the provider of the maltas, so I did get some pressure from her, but she understood after, you know, she saw what a wreck I was, that it just wasn't going to be possible for me to do it, so that it was just going to be healthier all around for me to not do it.
There's so many factors to consider in deciding whether you want to breastfeed and for how long. Sharon Medrano.
In the end, it's your baby, and you know what's right, and you know what feels right, or what you want to do.
As in so many health decisions, when it comes to breastfeeding, ignore the haters. Feel free to make your own choices, but know what you're getting into. The mommy wars start at breastfeeding and end at never. For Latino USA, I'm Brenda Salinas.
We've been talking today about what it means to be hurt. But sometimes you want to feel a little bit of that burn. Recently, I went down to Laredo, Texas with our senior producer, AC Valdez, and our producer, Marlon Bishop. And at AC's suggestion, we decided to check out some folks who are, well, gluttons for punishment and pain.
What can you tell me is the first tip to eating as many jalapenos as possible?
You cannot care.
When it comes to eating jalapenos, Louis Bruni is both a Zen master and a veteran.
And my dad was one of the founding fathers of Jalapeno Festival, and I grew up around this. I do it in honor of him.
Just take a look at the tattoos on his arm, and you can tell he takes this seriously.
Each one of these stems represents every year that I've participated, the two that I've won.
This year is Luis's 10th time scarfing down jalapenos at record speed, well over 100 in just 15 minutes. And he's a two-time champ looking for a third win. So what does it take to make a champ?
I think a lot of stomach, you know, just being able to walk off stage. I think it's just a question of having that stamina.
Patrick Harrington would know. He manages La Costeña, the brand of pickled jalapenos that sponsors Laredo's annual jalapeno eating contest.
I think the jalapeno is just a very representative aspect of Mexican cuisine, Mexican cultural heritage.
Yes, it's an emblem of Mexican heritage, but you gotta remember, one way or another, you're going to feel the pain after 100 jalapenos. The top two contenders for this year's championship had pretty much the same advice. Just keep going.
What's your strategy? Do you have a strategy?
No. Just eat them.
Aniceto Mata, who goes by Nuno, is last year's champ. Depending on who you ask, he topped somewhere around 140 jalapenos last year. And don't think it's just guys who want to feel the burn.
Jackie Garcia.
Jackie Garcia?
Yes. I work at the U.S. consulate. Girls can take it to a whole other level. That's why I can eat like 1,000 chiles and it won't. It's not spicy at all.
As the time gets near, the rules are explained.
The rules are simple. All you have to do, you have to eat the entire jalapeno. You have to leave the stems behind. Those stems will be counted by the judges.
Oh, yeah. And one more thing.
If you feel sick, stop. You just might be the winner.
If the jalapenos come back up, well, you're disqualified.
Two! One! Go!
And they're off. Louis, behind a pair of shades and wearing a baseball cap, looks like one of those guys from a cable channel poker tournament. The crowd in front of us is cheering hard for Jackie nearly the whole time. You wonder how people keep their cool for nearly 15 minutes.
Four, three, two, one, zero. All right, everybody, put your jalapenos down now. Put your jalapenos down now. Let's drink a lot of cold beer.
And as the dust settles, the judges count out stem by stem and...
And the winner tonight, Big Louis Bruni at 135.
It's Louis Bruni. But the jalapeno eating world's not without its share of drama. Louis, it turns out, has a controversial technique. He bites the jalapeno and squishes the seeds out of the top. Some of Nuno's supporters wanted to register their complaints. Here's his niece, Angelica.
He didn't even eat the whole jalapeno. He would eat it and spit out the seeds, which that was part of the rules that you had to eat the whole jalapeno.
After three wins, Louis told me he was finished, retiring from jalapeno eating. As you can probably imagine, it takes a toll on your system.
I reached my legacy and I'm happy. 135's great.
135 jalapenos. But I can't help but wonder, would I be up to the challenge? Can I take the pain? I guess you've got to tune in next year and find out. For Latino USA, I'm AC Valdez.
And now, mis queridos, we leave you with a little sabiduría, some words of wisdom. Carolyn Mima Tejidor suffered for years in an abusive, silencing relationship with a man, a relationship that all but forced her to discover a new outlet for her pain, art. Here's Mima sharing some sabiduría about how art therapy helps heal and can take on a life of its own.
Let's see. My name is Mima, I'm 43 years old, and we are sitting in my art studio. And what you see around you is an array of artwork, a lot of it abstract work, some of it figurative. This was in 2006, and this was actually the first piece that I did. My hand was bandaged up. You can kind of see the scar there. Mm-hmm. That was in one of the first big physical confrontation we had. And I was hurt and I was confused and I was angry and, you know, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what was happening to me. I loved him. I thought he loved me. And we were both fine. We both had really good jobs and I just didn't get it. That night, it was, I want to say, 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and I couldn't sleep, and I was sweating a lot and tossing and turning, and kind of, I heard this voice say, "Paint it." The summer after I got out of that relationship, I was free. You know, he wasn't in the house, he wasn't near me, he couldn't contact me, but I felt that sense of, okay, now I can start to do what I need to do to get better. We can start on this side if you want. You know, some of my friends would tell me, you should show your work, you know, go to a gallery and try to get your work into a gallery. And I just didn't have that confidence in myself. I really didn't. They recommended this artisans fair that they do every year. It's in an open area and there are going to be a lot of other artists there. So I figured, okay, I'll give it a try. So I looked at the space and I said, you know, this would be a nice space to do an art show. Yeah, and I said, you know, I think that'd be cool, you know, for me to find some artists that have never shown their work before. I would prefer that. This is all that conversation. And so I prefer it because I remember how hard it was for me. And it was a great turnout. I've spoken with a lot of different women who have been through a domestic violence experience. And one of the things that I hear them say a lot is that they just want to forget about it. They want to forget about that time in their lives. And some people have actually told me that they don't think it's a good idea that I remember those things. I don't think that that's true. My artwork allows me to go back. It has allowed me to go back and really understand how I felt in that situation to begin with. Through that whole process, I've healed and I've learned about myself. I've learned about my womanhood. And more importantly, I've learned who I am. My artwork has allowed me to question me.
Mima Tejidor is the curator of the bi-monthly art exhibit La Mimosa, held in New York City. You can find more information about La Mimosa at their website, thedisplay.org. And you can check out pictures of Mima's own work on our website, latinousa.org. And that's it for this week, people. All of us are wishing you healing from your hurts and a restful week. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Brenda Salinas, Camilo Vargas, and Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Antonia Cerejido and Daniel Gunter. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks to WGBH in Boston for helping us out this week. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and on Tumblr, and I'll see you on my Instagram, Maria_la_Hinojosa. Hasta la próxima, gente.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
And then you just kind of squish out the rest right here with your tongue.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.com. And the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.